Welcome to this edition of the Cyber Show. I'm here this evening with a guest we've had previously, Rob Thomas, and a new guest with us today, Stephen Monslow, is a pure data programmer, an artist, and who is right at the heart of the algorave scene. And we're going to be talking a bit about algorithmic rave, about VJing and event organizing. But before we get onto that, Rob, last time we were together, we were talking about AI in music. What's happened since then?
Yeah, well, it's what everyone's been talking about, I suppose. Never-ending conversation. Well, what's happened since then? I can't really remember. Maybe some of the models have just got a bit better. I would say I'm not sure if the lawsuits had happened by that time. Do you remember if that's true?
We weren't talking much about copyright and the mass kind of.
I think they might not have happened. So I think since then, all of the major labels are taking Suno and Udio, which are like some of the bigger music AI companies, to court for, I think, what they called mass copyright infringement by scraping effectively their whole catalogs and using them as training data, which is kind of interesting to see where that will go. So the thing that I don't think that had happened when we spoke last. I would say, like, you know, in the kind of background, I know that there's, you know, even though those types of things are happening, there's a lot of things going on with catalog and artists, which are about, okay, well, if we are going to license content, that license catalog, then, you know, what kind of deals can we do with that?
It's kind of trying to find a legitimate groove there, yeah. Isn't it? I met Stephen because I wrote a blog piece on Cybershow blog, and I think he'll correct me if I'm wrong, but I think I posted it on Hacker News or something, and a few days later, I had a message in my inbox, which was, I've made a track using your blog piece as a kind of compositional seed for some kind of crazy AI. And I listened to it and absolutely blew me away because I didn't, you know, it was, for me, it's like one of those old fart moments that, oh my God, the kids can do that now. Stephen, tell us, the listeners, about that and how you made it.
So I did actually use Udio, and I took segments of the blog post and I put it into Udio. But I've been doing prompt engineering with earlier models like Music Gen, and I spent a huge amount of time trying to kind of get. So obviously these models can generate what I call tacky Instagram music quite easily, but I'm interested in creating, you know, crazy drum and bass. And really just, curating it. And so of the 90%, of the percentage that I would create, I would throw away 90% of it. So I kind of picked various genres, created these different at the output, and then I just kind of put it into one big long track. I've been doing it for quite a long time now, to see what the, because I'm interested in genre interpolation, so to see, can the model take two completely different genres and interpolate between them? And the models are actually pretty terrible at that.
That morphing. They're in the 90s, like morphing was the big thing, yeah.
Yeah, there was cross synthesis, but it was also, and you know, you do it with, you know, the FFT and stuff, but it wasn't necessarily genre interpolation. The other thing that I find that these music models can't do is, so for example, if you say to it, I want a wood block, and I want you to have a single wood block with 5 seconds of silence in between. I just want, you know, it basically takes that as a wild card and gives you whatever the hell it wants. So it can't take very exacting instructions. And
it's like the drummer from Spinal Tap. He just can't do a straight four. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, you can ask for more cowbell. You can put. I've tried all these different things with prompt engineering. What I find though is that the Music Gen models, they have a very tinny output, but they you can do more work in the prompt engineering stage. With the Udio stuff, they have a lot more magic going on with the prompt. So if you type in Philip Glass, this is one of the things I like doing. I was like, can you make me a Philip Glass composition? It will say, oh, no, I couldn't possibly do that. But I will make you a, you know, contemporary minimalism thing, blah, 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 which sounds just like Philip Glass anyway. And you can do 40 minutes of near enough Philip Glass music that he would be spinning, if he was dead, spinning in his grave, if you heard it.
He spinning in his grave, or is Philip Glass still with us?
No, I said if he was dead, he'd be spinning in his grave, but he's not dead, so he's still alive.
No, and so if he's listening, I hope he's at least a little bit pleased that it wouldn't do that for you.
I think actually some of the problems actually with the examples in the lawsuits with Udyr and Suno are actually where people have done that. Basically, they've tried to force it to recreate the training data, and they've been pretty successful at doing it. So yeah, like this, they've tried to abstract away the prompt so that you can't just say you want ABBA, but then if you just describe it well enough, it will just make you ABBA.
But isn't it okay for an artist to do that? Because I made a patch, a PD patch, not way back, after I was on a tour, and I was with System 7, and I just had lots of time to sort of study some of their symptoms. And I came back one night and just built this patch called the Hillogizer, and it basically creates like Steve Hillage music in an uncanny way. I mean, I have no idea thinking about it now how I actually built that. But, it was a homage, and I'm sure that if Steve Hillage heard that, I'm sure he'd be proud of it and love it in a funny kind of way. Mm-hmm. I don't think he'd be pissed off.
Well, I think the big debate that's going on at the moment is about consent and what the kind of ethics are of creating a tool without the consent of artists, which could, you know, significantly disrupt the practice, but you know, and then if they are making money out of it, then they're living. So that's the kind of the huge debate that's going on around it at the moment, around consent with training data. You know,
the other thing as well you can do with it is that you can create, for example, a new Elvis Presley track. So the consent of an artist that is no longer with us is probably easier. It's a kind of a gray area. So that was something that people have realized, that you know, you can create these weird pseudo Beatles tracks that sound a bit like
how Oasis made their career.
So just one example of that is I actually uploaded a sample of John Lennon singing into, I think it was Udyr or Suno. I reversed it, and then I asked it to make a song, and it completely bypassed the copyright filter. And then I gave it lyrics, and it made lyrics that sounded in the voice of John Lennon. So you can do little tricks like that, and it is completely open for abuse. I don't know what you'd call like necro music or whatever, but so the question of you're assimilating the way that an artist would make music to such an extent that you can copy them without infringing copyright is the bit that people are most, I think, kind of scared of, because all of these stock music creators are kind of, you know, worried about it. And also, we should be making robots that do our dishes, right? We shouldn't be making robots that do the things that we as humans want to do.
We should be making new music based on the next generation, maybe. I don't know.
You're listening to The Cyber Show on www.cybershow.uk.
We're just chatting about Algorave.
Okay, cool.
And we're chatting about event organising and what a thankless, funny task that can be. and we're talking about, like, how do you make money in music without selling your soul, basically?
You don't.
Yeah, that's true. That's what we kind of coalesced on. Yeah.
Well, maybe you do, but you're basically just did it by luck if that happens.
Yeah, I'm doing the Frank Zappa approach where I just funnel money from other sources into stuff that I like and don't care what anyone else thinks about it, which is what works for me. But it doesn't actually necessarily have to work. It just exists, and I can just not care what anyone thinks about it, and that's fine.
Well, I say it as a joke, but it is kind of serious, really, because I think if you're the more I the older I get, I think like the you know, if you're an artist basically, then what you're doing is ultimately just doing exactly what you want to do, like in the purest sense, and you're just sort of hoping that that like resonates with the rest of society. So in some ways it is pure luck really, that you, what you want to do and what you are as a human being just happens to resonate with enough people in society that they want to pay you loads of money for it. So I think it's kind of in some ways that's quite liberating, because it just means just do what the fuck you want, and if it's going to work, it will. And if it doesn't, then it's kind of not really anything to do with you, it's to do with everybody else, you know.
Yeah, I mean, you in the back of your head, I'm sure you're thinking, oh, this will impress at least one person that I know. And also,
well, I think that's like what someone like Rick Rubin would say is not being an artist, is if you're ever thinking about somebody else,
okay,
then you're not really being a pure artist. But at the same time, that's, you know, that kind of that's so extreme in the real world. It's such as
that can be a really horrible path to self-indulgence, can't it? Yeah. And I think that what you're doing is treading it on a tightrope between some sort of narcissistic self-indulgence and being too much of a pleaser.
Yeah.
To bring this around to the Algarve scene, is famously incredibly inclusive, and for the first, well, it's at least 10 years old now, you know, they would welcome beginners, they would give them a slot. The beginners would potentially play a very boring, repetitive set to a crowd of very welcoming and accommodating people. And that happened for a long time. And only now, after 10 years, are some really amazing people kind of flourishing and doing stuff which just sounds like the craziest music you could possibly think of, a hyper music that other producers would scratch their heads and think, well, how have you made that? And it's all happening live. But that took a long time, and the faked act stuff is a bit more kind of like, I'm the curator, and I have a tight criteria, but it's open ended in some way. So I want AV artists, I want VJs, I want DJs can play, but I want it to sound like dance music. I want it to be, you know, it's kind of have one foot in experimental, but also ideally be something like 90s rave culture as well. And I have to kind of like crack the whip sometimes. And sometimes I'll book someone and they'll say, yeah, that's fine, I'll do that. They'll turn up and they'll just do exactly whatever the hell they want. And they just won't listen as well, and they'll just do half an hour of white noise. And you'll go, oh, great, cheers for that. So that happens. and my opinion is that it's actually much harder to make algorithmic drum and bass or algorithmic whatever genre than it is to make what I'm being a bit facetious, but like arty farty self-indulgent art, you know, arty stuff, which is largely just like squelching noises. And really, the first, you know, it's very easy in Super Collider to make a sine wave and have it an FM and do these things, and it's like, great, yeah, but have you tried, you know, trying sculpting something a little bit more, you know, detailed, or with like having a bit of like a goalpost you're going for? And a lot of artists don't necessarily think about it like that. So I'm selling out, but I'm selling out in a very narrow way, and trying to create a club night that you can kind of go there and, you know, get mashed up and, you know, rave there. But it's also very, very, very interesting how it's done. So that's kind of what I was going for with it. And also, I just love visuals and VJing, and I'm very, what's the word? Not so there is VJing is typically, you know, the domain of people who are quite anonymous in the background. You know, they're not really famous, they're not really, you know, thought of. I think VJing, well, it is more of an art form. And it's very exciting, but the mainstream consciousness doesn't really, there's no famous VJs, I don't think. And VJing is also the commercialized aspect of it is, well, you need to download Resolume or Modulate or some other software. You need to buy a VJ loop pack and you need to use a kaleidoscope effect, and that's how you become a VJ.
Yeah, it's very, very expensive. I mean, some of that kind of, I always saw, you know, the DJs come on, they've got a couple of, SL1200 turntables or CD decks or whatever. I guess your outlay there is like a couple of grand, but the DJs come on and they'd have this insanely expensive kit of like high intensity projectors and video mixers, and I always kind of thought that there was something almost a completely different level of production going on with DJing.
Yeah, there's also so when projection mapping came out, it got quickly assimilated by advertising, and the main software that all the big advertisers use is called Touch Designer, which I'm not really a fan of. And they spend a lot of money on hardware. It all has to be compatible with the software, which is also expensive. And it's this kind of idea that, oh, we have to be a big business. We have to have all this money going out, and they have all this gear, all this projectors. But actually, the stuff I'm interested in is more like, okay, you got a laptop, you're running pure data in GEM, you're building your own algorithmic visual system. There isn't really that much gear going on. The only limitation is your ability, your experience with programming. And that is kind of the antithesis of that approach. And that's the stuff that I try and get people to get on board with. If someone turns up to FakeDAC and they've got loads and loads and loads of equipment, it's normally a bad sign. It's normally like a red flag, like, oh, this is going to be pretty tacky and void of taste. The people that turn up with a laptop and have sat studiously in their bedroom for 10 years creating patches or code, they normally have way more interesting content because they're not obsessed with gear. They're obsessed with, you know, what can I, you know, it's the limitation is quite good. So Louis, I know I keep, like, Louis Sanders, the co-founder of FakeDAC, he has a lot of content, but he's building his own system that is very flexible. So I've never seen him do the same gig twice. And I went with him around doing different, like when I visited him in Switzerland, I'd follow him along for a bit and he'd pay me half of his booking fee. And I was skint student time. And I've never seen him play the same VJ set twice. And it's always very, very different. But that was with the same patch that he'd, at the time it was all Quartz Composer, I think, running through VDMX. And, you know, it was all geometric, you know, particle systems, you know, standard kind of stuff. But he would never, it would always look visually different each time. And then you compare that to someone who had a big hard drive of VJ loops. Those VJ loops largely were just like moving through a tunnel. I don't know if you've seen these VJ loops where you're just going through a tunnel of some kind, and then they'd leave it running for 15 minutes, and so this is the thing with VJing is that people's visual attention span is much less than with audio, and I think that we need things to change more quickly, not because we're all, you know, void of attention span, but just because our brain needs stimulus like that. And if you're playing the same loop for 15 minutes and then you play another loop, and also kaleidoscope is just an absolute no-no. Like, you do not use kaleidoscope. You can use kaleidoscope and you can make it work, but normally that is the last resort of someone who cannot get any more interesting output from their system and they're just resorting to the...
Yeah, massively into VJing. Just thinking of end of the 90s or mid to late 90s, and the kind of mid to late days of the ambient electronic scene. The people that I knew that put stuff on there, like, for example, let's think, Bobby and Magda used to do these things called, they were Higher Intelligence Agency, and they used to have this party called Oscillate, and, you know, put it on all over the place. But, you know, I think to them, it was like they were making a party for friends. And the love that came back from that, you know, people would just bake cakes for them and it was just such an amazing vibe. But there was never any attempt there to turn it into something that it wasn't. And it had, you know, and it had its life cycle. But that I'm just sort of thinking of the vibe of a different way of approaching organizing events. Once money comes in and once people start to try, you know, there's investors that want to take over your gig and offer you the world, moon on a stick.
Yeah.
That's not going to work.
So hopefully, okay. So with the Algorave stuff, the live coding, there's an aspect of it that's a bit more, so like they share code. They've got, you know, people put code on GitHub. And what, an idea that I think is unexplored is, and it's very anti-capitalism in a way, is like, why are we trying to sell static audio artifacts and music when a whole other community could be based around sharing patches or code directly? And that could be the medium. So, you know, a bit like in the punk rock days, you would get a guitar, learn three chords, and you'd be cooking with gas. You're in a band and you go around playing gigs. In this kind of world, you wouldn't release your music. You would release the code that creates your music with no dependencies. That would be in some sort of marketplace. It may or may not be sold. It may just be given away for free. And then other people would download the code, run it, modify it, and then they would be like, feel that they were famous. So they could play gigs, completely rip you off. And you have this kind of ecosystem of sharing a different medium, which is not, you know, it's dynamic because the actual code can produce any output, it can run indefinitely. And these sort of ideas are not inherently easily commodified. And what I'm getting at is, are we looking about this the wrong way? Like, you know, the whole question about, you know, can art really actually be a product? We can coerce it into being a product and be commercial. We can invent the concept of business around it, but it's a very thin construct. And actually, maybe that's why everything's going wrong, because if you said to someone, you're not going to get loads of money, you're going to get a bit of money to survive, you're going to be able to play gigs every night, and you're going to be part of an exciting evolution of culture, and maybe like in the far future you'll get loads of rewards and you'll be able to, you know, monetize what you've done, but right now you're going to get paid very little, but you're going to be really at the cutting edge. And you know, I don't think people would necessarily turn up the nose at that, and they would, I think that people, and that's kind of what I think we should be doing. I think, you know, yeah, I know I haven't really explained it in that much detail, but just like the general idea of maybe we need to abandon the idea of being able to own culture, own music and stuff, and we need to just be thinking about that kind of melting pot a bit more, and ideas that aren't necessarily like, because I think, you know, the business music industry, it relies on you having a very clear image of what you're getting. Like, you're going to give me £10, I'm going to give you a CD, that CD is going to have 11 tracks on it, it's going to be of someone quite current at this moment in time. You're going to be able to brag to your friends that you've got the CD and play it in your car until the next CD comes out. That was the typical model. And maybe that is what is kind of like just killing everything now and making it all boring, because, you know, and now I've got the DJ model where, oh, you like music, do you? Okay, well, go to Ibiza, spend £150, go to a nightclub, get off your head, and then it's one big piece of music all in, you know, in sequence without breaks. You don't know who's attributed to what piece of music, really. It all sounds the same anyway, and it isn't really original, but who cares, because, you know, you're off your head. So it's kind of that's what you're paying for an experience then.
What you invoke there is these distinct concepts of the recording industry. You know, it's different from the music. I mean, even to call it an industry now just seems weird, because, well, what isn't an industry? You know, that's one of the great products of late stage capitalism, is that everything becomes an industry. You know, it's like the childcare industry. Yeah, so that industrialization of art through the recording business, which was, you know, just one of the hugest events in the last century, absolutely changed the way that people think about music. Have you heard of Leonard Paul?
I haven't, no.
He's a pure data programmer, a very accomplished PD programmer. Many years ago, we sat in a cafe in London and had this kind of similar conversation about. He did it. I mean, to his credit, he basically produced an album entirely as code, and you could download it. And this was like I'm saying 5, maybe 6 years ahead of RJDJ. That was one of the great gigs that we did. We had a businessman called Michael Bridenbrook. He's was also a founder of Last FM. But the actual interesting project that he did was RJDJ, and we released music as code, and that was commercially successful for a while. But you know, and I really got into deeply philosophically analysing this. Why did that not become the new musical paradigm? And the answer is, I think, that people like their music to be the same every time they listen to it.
Yeah, the world wasn't ready for you, but you're basically ahead of your time with that one.
You're listening to The Cyber Show.
Hello, I'm Stephen Monslow, co-founder of FakeDAC, an event dedicated to audio visuals and Algorave. And here is a medley of audio that I've generated using generative AI from the Udio platform, and which I would recommend playing around with. But I find live coding and algorithmic systems more musical for performing live, but I wouldn't limit the use of generative AI for installations and for other experiments. So here's a short medley of different output that I've generated. Audiovisual monsters of Batman, fake that. Generate a fake check in place.
There is a making of mention. Fake deck. Algorave audio visual monsters of Batman.
Somebody from Berkeley asked me to talk to one of their students recently, and he was. We had a big conversation about AI and also generative music, as in the old use of that term, which has kind of been co-opted now by generative AI. What came out of that conversation was quite interesting for me. So, what I found myself saying by the end of it was that. My experience with algorithms and and using machine learning, and especially these deep learning models, is that they're almost like two kind of different approaches, like different directions of artistic exploration. So when I work with, you know, making algorithms in pure data or making some rule-based systems or whatever they are, so I mean, you know, I'm creating those systems and controlling everything about them, and I'm sort of setting them in motion, but then reacting to them and changing them in a micro level continuously in a kind of flow with that algorithm, you know. That's like what I think of as like an expanding sort of exploratory process, because you start with something very small and you allow that to grow. Like Brian Eno says, you know, he's always saying it's like gardening, like the algorithmic and generative is gardening instead of architecture, you know. Whenever I work with machine learning or anything that's, you know, bigger than some Markov chain that you can poke around in, I always feel, and it feels like a huge, enormous black box that I'm trying to kind of coax into the direction I want it to go. And most of the time, like you said, it's, you know, going in completely the wrong direction, and I'm sort of throwing loads of it away and stripping out stuff and kind of trying to force it into a direction. So it's like that always feels like a reduction of possibilities. So you start with this huge, enormous thing and you kind of strip it down. So you're sculpting down towards something. And I think that, you know, I've worked in both of those directions. In fact, you know, it was more interesting working with machine learning and AI actually when it was kind of shittier than it is now, which you might have found as well, Stephen, with Music Gen. So in terms of like the more interesting things came out of it going wrong, and then me kind of finding interesting wrongness in it, sort of thing.
Yeah, and before Music Gen, there was a period where you could only really get MIDI output from these machines. There was a lot of work going into just MIDI.
Yeah.
And I was always thinking, wouldn't it be cool if it could make, you know, wave files? Never did I think in a million years that it would cause all of this ruckus and all of this hoo-ha with everyone kind of like getting worried.
Yeah, well, I remember when WaveNet happened, that was like, okay, it's going to happen. Like that was, I remember that moment thinking, okay, it's just going to be about enough training data and enough like compute to get it up to be good sounding. But yeah, in some ways, like I think MIDI was more, the MIDI sort of the symbolic models were more interesting because they would poke your compositional process rather than your sound design process in some ways, you know. So like I did a piece of this must be about like 8 years ago now with the LA Phil, and it was too early for the music, the audio generation stuff wasn't progressed enough by that time, so we were extracting MIDI from lots of their recordings and also using like MIDI of pieces like The Rite of Spring and Mahler and stuff like that. And then we used this Clara model, which basically would spit out crazy MIDI sort of extensions of bits of the Rite of Spring. And that was amazingly interesting because it would just sort of stop the normal part of the Rite of Spring and then go off into some weird chromatic madness.
I found that very interesting when you mentioned that in the last episode, and the extrapolation is, I find that a very interesting technique and an interesting use of machine learning. And of course, that was always there when we were back in the days when we were playing with Markov stuff, wasn't it? That you'd kind of give it something and then say, please continue.
I think what's interesting about it is that it's sufficiently open to be also kind of like a bit like Stravinsky, but also very much not like it. So you get this mixture of, you know, not overfitting to something which is like, okay, you know, like we said before with ABBA, okay, that's just sounds like ABBA, like a pastiche or something. It's kind of like, okay, it's Stravinsky on acid or something, you know. And that was very exciting for me. And that's still now, whenever I use, you know, small scale machine learning, which is, you know, realistically, that's all you can do in a patch, really. It's kind of, it is always to get little chunks of patches which are doing their own weirdness like that, you know.
What I'd like to do is to take the conversation on to some practicalities, because Stephen, you mentioned running models locally on you know, not even a very expensive graphics card, just a sort of fairly decent graphics card. And you know, for us to just go into this subject for a little while, of the problem of cloud-based AI and the fact that you're feeding, you know, I do dislike the term intellectual property, so I'll just call them your ideas. You're feeding your stuff to something which is taking it. And many artists prefer the cloisters of the studio and to be able to work on something until it's ready to release. I mean, that's where the idea of the release comes from, right? And the recording industry. So talk us through a little bit about your kind of rig, really, and how you work with that.
Yeah, one thing I would say is you can't really run the music stuff locally very easily, and I have tried. So there's a model called Mustango, and there's Music Gen, and in theory you can run it locally, but in practice you'd need a very, very, very fast computer with a very nice graphics card, and it would be an absolute pain to install. You would get it all configured with Python, and then, you know, if you wanted to try something else, you would have to faff around with Python environments and all that kind of stuff, and then you would wait for much longer than you would in the cloud for your output, because the stuff in the cloud typically runs on much bigger computers. So that's one of the problems of running music locally. In terms of large language models, there's a model called Tiny Dolphin, which is a very, very powerful CPU model that can run happily on a CPU. It can run on a very normal computer without a GPU. It's not nowhere near as powerful as and, you know, the ones that you would get with OpenAI, but crucially it's uncensored, which is a whole other topic. So, you know, there's people that say, you know, you should not be censoring your large language models, it's pointless, and other people that say, well, if it can tell you how to make a bomb or do all this kind of stuff, then maybe you should. But so that's a whole other thing. So it's an uncensored model. So obviously large language models are basically toy AI, really. They're sophisticated chatbots, and what people are finding is that when you run out of training data and you have big enough computers and you have a large number of parameters, there's a kind of like a flattening off where you don't really get the improvements that you were seeing before. This is the bottleneck that OpenAI are kind of like not really advertising very loudly, because they're encountering it. It's like, well, we've got, you know, ever increasing amount of training data, ever bigger computers, ever etc., and yet the actual thing that it's people were telling that it will be able to do has stopped improving. And that is the limitation of essentially
asymptotic to kind of fairly okay, and it's not going to get beyond fairly okay.
You can, one of the things that I did, because I have one of my hobbies when I get time to do it, is I do a bit of bug bounty hunting very badly. One of the things that I built was a system that would essentially proxy all of the requests going through an application as you traverse it, and then it would chunk it into small chunks, and I'd use a large language model running locally to ask questions about it. And, you know, it's incredibly wasteful, really. And, you know, you could use regular expressions, and you could say, you know, do you see a secret here? Can you spot an XSS or all that kind of stuff? And, you know, it's fun to some extent, but eventually it's not really that interesting. So to your question, yes, you can run models locally with varying success if you do have a huge computer or data center. Yes, I guess you can do it locally, but I would imagine it's probably easier just to sit around and wait for a better model to come along and then just use that. In terms of data privacy, yes, you will need to run one locally if you're trying to maintain any sort of data privacy, because it's typically like they'll say, yeah, well, if you pay us extra, we won't train your data, and then you have to kind of just believe them, which is a silly. I just find that really silly to do that. The last thing I would say is back to what I wanted to say this earlier, is that one of the things that I do with music, what I do now, so I went for a stint of making really, really cool music with UDO, like just crazy drum and bass, etc. And I did a live show at an Algarave where I performed that music live, and it sounded really, really interesting, but I just felt bored. I was on stage, I was pressing play on these different tracks, and I felt like a DJ and it felt boring. So what I do now is I create the track, which is, I think, is interesting. I ask for it without drums. I download the stems. Then I, from the command line, I split on silence. I load those individual sounds into a folder and I trigger them from my Pure Data algorithmic patch. And that's kind of like a hybrid approach that I do now. The other thing I've tried is called revoicing, where I'll take the track made from UDO, I'll split it on stems. I'll then run each stem, I will do beat tracking or pitch detection on, and I'll revoice it in other instruments, etc. It suffers from latency, but that's another technique that is a slightly more hybrid approach. So I think there's a hell of a lot of room for creativity. And there are a few kind of like, you know, obvious kind of like dead ends or pitfalls or things you can do with it. I kind of just see it as a shiny toy to play with, and I'm not really, you know, expecting too much from it.
Great to hear those techniques and how you approach it. I think that's very inspirational to other listeners thinking of how to treat this as an artistic tool. I mean, what do you make of that, Rob? Your workflow is more recording and soundtrack orientated, isn't it? But does some of those techniques make sense?
Yeah, I mean, what I was thinking as I was listening is, you know, again, what it comes down to really, and what I always get in these conversations is like, what is creativity, and what is the process of doing that? And, you know, it kind of makes me laugh when I read on UDO's website where they sort of saying, well, now anyone can create music, and okay, well, you put a prompt in and something will happen. Yeah, but the question for me is like, okay, which and how much creativity is going on in that process? And
it's like Guitar Hero. It's like Guitar Hero, right?
Yeah,
Or Dance EJ. I used to love Dance EJ, and I felt like a producer, like a rock pop star making.
Yeah. So like how creative it is, like for me is always in, not just, you know, with AI, but in anything is how many decisions you're making. Basically, I think that creativity is about a very significant amount of decisions, even if they're not conscious decisions really, but you're making them, and also making them in response in a lot of creative.
That's the key, yeah. I think, Robin, yeah. And just going, seizing on something that Stephen just said about how he felt bored, just simply using a tool that was, you know, completely wiping your ass for you. And what I was thinking of is, where's the fear? What I used to love, going back, thinking back to the kind of Shoreditch live coding scene and Go to 10 and all of that, is that we would go up on stage with the most precarious setup imaginable, you know, with a patch that you were still patching as you were sort of sitting listening to other people's stuff. And then you'd take it up and with your heart pounding, because you knew that like one, you know, wrong click and the whole patch would crash. You blow the speakers and it would just deafen everybody and set fire to the venue. I mean, that fear factor was just really classic.
Well, fear is a good thing to have a certain amount. I mean, I think Bowie said like that, you know, you should feel uncomfortable. In a creative process, you should always feel slightly out of your depth, I think.
Right, so, yeah.
So I think fear is good, but it's also just sort of discovery and making decisions based on a reaction to what's going on right now. So, you know, the difficult thing about prompting and then getting the result, the entire result fully formed land in front of you, is that there's no time to make that discovery and those decisions and that reaction during the process. So
it's like ordering it from Amazon, isn't it? And it comes, oh great,
yeah, one second later you've got it. So I am interested in, you know, when that process gets broken down, and I think that will be very exciting. It's starting to happen now with these tools. And then when you also, you know, if you make stuff using machine learning models, and they'd throw all of that into like RipX or something like that, which will like split it all apart and do sort of pitch analysis, and you can pull around that content in the pitch domain and the time domain, and you know, kind of interesting. But then I, for me, that's like, okay, now this is just one other part of this big mixture of creative tools that let us just sort of mess about with sound and music and composition, which is great, you know. So I think then it becomes just, you know, like another extension of what composers and musicians do. The more problematic thing is, I think, is this, you know, a social and political thing, which is like abstracting away creativity away from creatives effectively, and sort of automating the generation of this horrible word content.
Yeah, content. Let me just throw something into the mix there then, which is, you know, you asked the question, what is creativity? My way of phrasing that is where do the ideas come from? Because in the sort of very spiritual, authentic tradition of composition, you know, you're a channel for you know, God's music. It comes from the universe and it comes through you, and you make something. And sometimes you listen to it and you go, oh, I don't know how I did that, but I did. Mm. When you're working with very powerful tools that somebody else has trained, and synthesizers that other people have built, you know, and you just press one button and it makes a whole track for you. You know, whose music? Where do the ideas come from now?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's always going to be, you know, I wouldn't say what his name was now anyway, because of what I'm about to say, but it was a lecturer in music AI at one of the London universities. And I had this massive argument with him because he was saying that, that music is just music, you know, it's just like if you describe the probabilities, like if you looked inside of the model in one of these models, that is the music. That is like the entire description of the music.
Super reductionist philosophy, yeah.
Yeah, and I was kind of saying, well, you know, it's almost like the just one fragment of what the music is. You know, what the music really is the life of the whole life of the creator up until that point, and the articulation of that life and that experience into that piece of music for whatever artistic reason that we may never really understand, they may never understand. And then this thing kind of comes out into the world. That's like just like a little fragment of it, the actual embodiment of that in the world. And then it's like, how does it exist in society, and how does it fit into society and evolve in society? And, you know, does it become like Three Lions, or does it become A Day in the Life, or does it become some obscure thing that doesn't mean anything to anyone? Or, you know, so that's sort of where the ideas come from, and that's where the ideas go as well in society, you know?
So where does your consciousness come from? It's like the same sort of thing. I think there's like an unknowable aspect of being alive. And I was just thinking as you're talking, like, so, you know, you have famous paintings. You'll see a painting hanging in a gallery, and because that painting is hanging in a gallery and someone said that that's a nice painting, that is, you know, the context, that is an art form, that's culture. And maybe that we're just hanging these kind of descriptive, these kind of hanging our own interpretation, but actually it's the same reason why we can't describe what our consciousness is. It's because we don't know where our it's that kind of, we're getting a bit fuzzy and a bit deep, but you know, with the whole, we can have a music business, but it's still a thin veneer over something that no one really fully understands or probably can't understand. And
I've been lucky in terms of like talking with and like collaborating with a lot of artists that have somehow made something that has this resonance through society. And, you know, I don't think any of them would ever really say that they understand why that's happened with the things that they do, or why they in particular have had that as an opportunity, or, you know, why they are interesting to people. And So
that Rob is actually a very, very interesting point that kind of echoes back to something that Stephen and I were talking about just before you came to the studio, which was that the ephemerality of creative life, and you can make something and absolutely hits the mark and the room goes wild and everybody loves it, or you sell a million records. Can you reproduce that phenomenon? Can you bottle the magic, which is what the music business is then about, which is, we need the same producer, we need the same sound, we need the same microphones, we need the same magic in the studio. And often you can't. But what happens is that culture gets into a little loop, just trying to recreate that high point experience again and again. Stephen said that's what he thought the whole rave scene was, really, was just an echo chamber of like one or two things that happened that were good ones.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I've given up trying to sort of get to the bottom of that. I think all that really matters is, in your own creative practice is some kind of integrity and sort of honesty about what you really want to do,
Absolutely, and keep pushing it forwards.
Yeah.
Otherwise the past is dragging you back, isn't it? Trying to take you back to that, recreating that thing that you'll never do as good again. And even if you did, you won't really know why.
I think one thing I've sort of found as useful is trying to describe to myself what I would like this music to feel like, or what this experience might feel like to other people. Or what I would like it to feel like to me, in a way that is not limited by the types of things that are normally, necessarily possible with technology and music. So allowing myself the freedom to think about those experiences very openly, but also try and be kind of sort of honest about like what I think would be interesting there, because it normally that helps me to not try and be nostalgic, to try and not try and recreate things that affected me in that way. So like, it makes me not want to make a concept album, or it makes me sort of. So even though those things were like amazingly important for me as an artist, it's like, okay, well, that, if you look at, say, I don't know, like Sgt. Pepper's or something, what was that to its time? What did that do in its time, in culture, in its time? So now what would the equivalent be now?
I can't believe you mentioned Sgt. Pepper's, because there's a conspiracy that I love from that time, which I don't think I'll divert the conversation from, but if you want to, maybe for another episode. But interestingly, if you only had the tools and materials that they had for making Sgt. Pepper's, and you're trying to make something new and culturally relevant today, would it just be that it's more and more difficult to do that because we've kind of explored every possible cool thing you can do with a guitar? But when someone sees someone playing guitar, in a way, it's pleasant because they know, oh, that's a human being strumming chords on a guitar. I know how that works. I know that it's very accessible because the paradigm is very straightforward. But when you see something that you haven't seen before, for example, with live coding in Algrave, like there's someone who's written some code on a screen, and you don't know, and that code is actually the thing that's making the sound, but you're not sure how that maps. It's all a bit of a foreign concept. And I just find that kind of one of the main reasons why Algrave is kind of slightly more interesting than some of the other kind of flogging a dead horse kind of things. Like, most nightclub events are just flogging a dead horse with the same paradigm, playing music through, CD players, through speakers to an audience that are expecting to hear the four to the floor, kick drum, and other things like...
That's functional music, isn't it? But I think what you're both describing there is that feeling of what it is in its own epoch is kind of shock and awe. Is like you suddenly hear something new, and there's that moment when you go, I have never heard anything like this before, and I like it.
Yeah, it's also the form of the experience. So, what you're describing there with Algarve is also to do with the form of the experience, in that you you know, because of the name of it and the event, and you can see that there's this unpredictable technological element that's going on, which is part of the excitement of the and the sort of frisson of like the moment, right? Because you sort of know that there's this wild thing in the room that's being kind of tamed.
And so you can feel it in everybody else as well. That's often a crowd experience rather than an individual one, isn't it?
Yeah. So I think in all of these different types of projects where you're doing something that is steps outside, you know, it's like, I call it like being off the tracks of like the normal way of doing music. Whenever you go off the tracks and there's something people that's different, you know, people know that they're sort of in a heightened state because of that. So it's like the equivalent of, you know, when people first saw Jimi Hendrix or something, and they knew that, you know, the feedback was this crazy thing that could just go all over the place, and he was like pushing the sound into like a different space. So I think that's why these things are interesting for people, even if they're not interested necessarily aesthetically in the output, they can be interested purely in the form. So, you know, a lot of projects, a lot of projects where, you know, I'll say, well, okay, this music is going to change when you run down the street, and it's going to like track how you run down the street. And if you stop, then it will like all change. And if you start running again, they'll go. So people will be purely interested in that as a concept, even if they're not necessarily into that from an aesthetic point of view of how it might do that. They might be into that as well. So like the form itself in these things can be like, attractive.
The way the reactive music was a hit, and yeah, we had that experience with RJ DJ. People were like, this is wow factor. It's music that changes like how you be depending on like how you're feeling or walking and the time of day. But then that was like the form of the music. It was reactive, and then we sort of found there was only so much we could do with that. Once that experience of sort of life, of real life gamified music had been absorbed, it didn't quite have the legs that we thought it was going to have.
Well, I think that's just about content, and I hate to use that word, but you know, basically, there is the entire recorded music history on Spotify. that's what you're, you know, the default of content is. Yeah. So, anything that goes beyond that, not just reactive music, anything that goes beyond that into a different realm of the form and structure or the delivery of music or how you experience it or anything is dealing with competing against that. Basically.
Yeah, I don't know if you heard the phrase interaction design. There was a phrase of, you know, a phase of people using sensors and 3D, you know, skeleton tracking, and there are lots of
nine was new interfaces.
These when you're doing anything that's not kind of something that people can wrap their head around, you are kind of up against it, because if it's not, you know, Pete Tong playing a DJ set in Ibiza, no one can really wrap their head around it. And you're trying to present something so alien to people that you'd have to literally be doing it consistently for 20, 30, 40 years for it to kind of become widely acknowledged and accepted, I think, because most people are very slow to adopt or understand very alien, and, you know, and especially if you haven't really taken the time to understand how computers work or how things really work at a low level.
You're listening to The Cyber Show on www.cybershow.uk.
So this is a piece which I did recently with a creative studio called Salul Studio from France, which it's a piece we did in Bologna with a series of dancers. And the music is responding to a machine vision algorithm from a camera, which is looking at the space. And as the dancers are moving around, it's influencing the algorithm to play music in different ways to reflect their movement. It's got three different phases in the piece of music. The first one represents the time before mankind was present on Earth. The second represents the period of mankind being present on Earth. And the third represents a hopeful future where we are in a kind of symbiocene with nature, a kind of harmony with the natural environment. So this is a little example of what that piece of music sounds like in a kind of compressed form, so you can hear all of the different stages quickly. It's called Destination Earth.
Tell us what's happening in your future, Stephen.
In terms of the Algorave scene and Fake Dak, so the last Fake Dak, I did a room two, which was a all night long. It was a generative AI content, so it was visuals, audio, running all night long randomly with projectors as an experiment, because just, you know, because it kind of to show people what the future might be when you go to a nightclub and there might not be any human beings performing. The next Fake Dak is on January the 29th, 2025, and that would be, it will feature an installation for Michael Jean Misera, who's very well known in the Algorave scene, and my good friend Daniel Arves, who he builds his own live coding system in Go called Cinta. His artist name is Cintillate. We collaborate at Corsica, and he runs the Algorave at Corsica. So every year now, we're going forward, we've got four dates, so two Algoraves and two Fake Dacks every year. There are other events popping up. There's an artist called Ecolag Borsak 2021, which is an acronym, which I can't remember. He's a very cool guy, and we've got a concept we're working on at Venue MOT, where, or maybe at Corsica, where the entire concept will be about surveillance. So we're going to try and create the creepiest nightclub experience with the creepiest amount of selling data, surveillance. It's going to be the attempt to make it so creepy that people think this is just ridiculous. We're going to have a very facetious online form that you can't really complete to get the tickets, and we're going to think of other ideas. I've had loads of ideas for it.
I'm too scared to go to that, and I would fail. But where can our listeners find out more about that? Have you got a site or URL?
Yeah, so the website is fakedac.net, fakedac.net. I forgot to mention the Algorave, next Algorave is on December the 10th of 2024 at Corsica. So I think if you go to fakedac.net or fakedac.net, that's the best place to go. And that's enough plugging for me. I appreciate that.
Rob, what's happening on your radar, and what's new in your
Well, one of them I probably can't talk about. It's basically I'm NDA'd up to my arse.
You could, but with all you'd have to kill us all. We know, yeah.
And then, but the other one is on the 29th, I think it is. It's a massive attack in Liverpool, which is part of this Act 1.5 thing, which is like Liverpool City of Culture accelerator around sort of low carbon music.
I love that you're still working with Massive and doing some kind of environmentally things. Tell me about the e-waste project a little bit more. So this is just an idea that's floating at the moment.
Well, yeah, I mean, this. So I basically, I've got another project, which is much sort of bigger thing. But one aspect of this was that I wanted to try and do at least part of that project entirely on e-waste. So the idea was, you know, to basically just give people old phones that had just been reconditioned. But it's just such a nightmare. It's like I'm sort of investigating how feasible it is, really. It's just, you know, apart from the security side of it, but just the, you know, practicality of actually doing that and getting these some old bricks running again and doing something with them, and, you know, all of the different making some way of supporting probably all of the fragmented OS that's on all of them and all this kind of stuff. So
you could run Linux, you could run some sort of I've got a Linux phone that I'm experimenting with. You could potentially just run a different operating system. I'm trying to think of the name of the one that I've something like Postmarket OS, I think I've tried, which is basically Alpine Linux with a
sideloading can be a real pain.
Yeah, it's just kind of jailbreaking them all, and if the batteries are all just worn out, just simple things like that, you know. So I don't know. I would love to do it. I would really love to make that project work somehow, but I'm a bit afraid of like the overhead of like actually just getting anything running on a serious amount of devices, you know.
Unless you made a generic app that runs through the App Store that can support legacy versions of Android and iOS, and then you just installed that on all of them and didn't try and refurbish them to an extent.
Yeah. It's just that, you know, people having old devices, is they just become not supported. They just become like sort of intentionally obsolete. So, you know.
What about you make it as a web page essentially, and that works on all old browsers, and that's the limitation, but it's basically a web page that runs on the.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one other fragment of this project is doing web page stuff using Tone.js. So, like, that's another aspect of it that I probably want to have some component in there. But it's native stuff is you know, quite nice in terms of like sensor interactions, and so it's a different. Each one of them is a sort of different incarnation of it, really. But yeah, this project in general is at a research phase, and so I'm kind of doing research around different directions as part of like the very early stages of it.
Ship them off to West Africa to be melted down by 12-year-old children. Let's make some plans. I've so enjoyed this evening's jibber jabber that and it would be really nice to plan another session, maybe in the new year, where we can maybe, you know, pick a different theme than sort of hands-on production, but, you know, it's still in an artistically informed vein, and maybe move on to a little bit of kind of tech rights. I mean, it's very, very, very interesting. There's so much change going on at the moment, like in the sort of Trump coming in and the changes in social media. So maybe we could collect some ideas together for sort of a bit more of a typically cyber show type things. Yeah, yeah,
I've got one. So what I'm working on is I'm going to basically create Fate Deck as basically a Instagram, SoundCloud kind of alternative for the Algarve scene. I'm going to host it from my home, off my home router, going, and I'm going to, it's all completely self-hosted. I use Phoenix and Elixir, and I'm very big into basically just creating a something that does not rely on big tech in any shape or form, and the sort of, yeah, so it's going to start off very small, self-hosted, and it's going to be the challenges, many challenges of doing that, and then it will eventually scale up, and it, yeah, so there's a lot of people that use Instagram for the Algarve scene, and my intention is to kind of steal them away and create a kind of an Algarve community that is essentially running, yeah, off a computer in my flat.
Raspberry Pi in your bedroom. I mean, yeah. That's amazing. I know our listeners will be absolutely big time into that, and that's really super exciting conversation. Well, it's lovely to hear both of you, and that's kind of wraps up the episode for today. We've covered so many cool things.
Yeah, it's been really good. Thank you for having me.
Nice one.
I really enjoyed the AI chat you had last time, because I was listening to it thinking, wow, like I basically agree with 100% of what I could, because yeah, there was bits where I was thinking this is spooky, because this is brilliant. But yeah, so yeah, I'll definitely check out your stuff. And in terms of like some of the more techie brainstorming stuff, there are a few I maybe be able to help with, you know, brainstorming certain things. Like, for example, the platform that I really like at the minute is called Nerves, and it's an Elixir embedded systems platform. So you can run it on a Raspberry Pi, but crucially, it runs with, you can run it where it, you can basically power it on without corrupting the hard, because it has two read-only file systems that it switches between.
Solar-powered websites, yeah, where you can just like get kind of like those cheap solar panels off like some crappy gardening things from garden ornaments from B&Q, put them on a Raspberry Pi Zero and have a website that only kind of comes on when the sun's shining.
If you did that on Raspbian, eventually your Pi would corrupt with the SD card, wouldn't work. But if you use Nerves, Elixir Nerves, it will run forever and ever. And also Elixir's built on top of Erlang. I don't know if you've heard of Erlang, but it's my favorite distributed programming environment language. But it's obviously way too difficult for mere mortals to program in Erlang, but Elixir is a Ruby syntax on top of the Beam, the Erlang virtual machine. Anyway, I'm so sorry, I'm just going to shut up now.
it's all good stuff. Absolutely brilliant to hear from you chaps. Have a good weekend, and we'll chat again soon. Good night,
right.
Lads.
Right. See you then.
See ya. All right, take care. Bye.